Welcome back to Issues Etc. This is the second hour. We're continuing a conversation with Dr. Cameron McKenzie on the diet at Worms. This hearing, this pivotal hearing that Luther had by hook or crook before the civil leaders of the Holy Roman Empire, wherein he either uttered or did not utter his famous words, "Here I stand, I can do no other, God help me." We'll talk about that a little bit later in our conversation. Dr. Cameron McKenzie is our guest. Tomorrow on the program, a two-hour discussion on papal authority and Roman Catholic doctrine with Dr. Ron Feuerhahn of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Dr. Cameron McKenzie is professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. If you have a question or a comment on the diet at Worms, call 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Those are our call-in numbers. Dr. McKenzie, welcome back.
Well, I'm still here. Glad to be back.
We've come to the point where the hearing at Worms is going to begin. How do we know what transpired here? They didn't have tape recordings.
Well, that's a good question. We have accounts by contemporaries of what was said. We actually have Luther writing about it and others who were there. So it's like contemporary accounts or near contemporary accounts by the participants or the witnesses.
So someone was either recalling later, was there an official record, a transcript, if you will, being made during these things?
You know, I think there was of a sort. I'd have to check that to be sure, but I think that they did have somebody take down stuff that official acts of the diet. So there would be some kind of official record, but it would not necessarily be a complete record. But that would be one of the sources. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that Luther was kind of a late addition to the agenda here.
Right.
The emperor had planned to meet with the princes and the heads of cities long before this. When does Luther enter the picture at the Diet at Worms?
Well, the decision actually to invite him. I mean, the emperor, I think, had planned just to condemn Luther. Under Frederick's prodding, he decides to invite Luther, and that occurs late February. The invitation actually goes out in March. Luther gets it probably the end of March, and he sets out for Worms the beginning of April, actually enters the city on April 16th. By which time, you know, they've already had meetings and discussions and stuff. The diet itself would be over by the end of May. So the Luther thing is toward the end of the diet.
So we're not talking about a two-day affair. We're talking about something that stretched out over several weeks.
Yeah, right. The diet itself lasted a few months.
All right. On his way, Luther is kind of got a traveling road show going.
Yeah.
As he's traveling to Worms.
He does. I mean, he first of all, there's an official escort. The emperor had guaranteed a safe conduct so that, although, in spite of the fact that Luther was now officially a heretic, nonetheless, he would be protected now by the emperor's representative, and so it was kind of an imperial procession. Luther himself was simply accompanied by one of his one or two, I can't remember, just a few colleagues from Wittenberg. But wherever he went, he was a celebrity, and to a lot of people, he was a hero. So crowds would turn out for him when he'd come to a city. The city dignitaries would greet him. He was sometimes given gifts. Other times he was given an opportunity to preach in prominent churches along the way. So it was not precisely what his opponents would have preferred. It was kind of a triumph that he experienced as he was going from Wittenberg to Worms.
He arrives there. He's scheduled on April 17th, late in the afternoon, to appear before the hearing.
Right.
What transpires?
Well, he is brought in, and the place is packed. There's a lot of interest in the Luther affair. So it's an official imperial escort that brings him in, and you know they kind of push their way toward the front, and there. the representative of the emperor. Actually, he's the representative of the Archbishop of Trier, who was acting in this regard as a spokesman for the imperial party, confronts him with a pile of books, and these turn out to be Luther's books. And he is asked if these books were all his. The lawyer for the elector kind of insists that all the titles be read, and they were, at the end of which Luther acknowledges, yes, those were all of his books, and then he added, but he had also written more. In other words, they weren't all there. And then, instead of being given some kind of a positive opportunity to present the main themes of these books or what his ministry was all about, he was instead simply asked this question. Would he now, did he now defend all of those books, or would he now repudiate their contents? In other words, not what's in them, but do you defend them, or do you take them back? In spite of the fact that Luther had been preparing, in a way, for this moment for the last several weeks and had expressed himself very confidently before he went that he was willing to go to the Diet of Worms even if all the tiles in the houses turned out to be demons, nonetheless, he seems to have been surprised by the directness of that question and by any lack of opportunity to explain. Or maybe it was simply the magnitude of the situation, because you have to remember his kind of social origins. He was simply a peasant's son. He came from the lower orders of the social structure. And there he was in the midst of the great of the earth. Archbishops, bishops, dukes, margraves, the emperor's brother, and the emperor himself. So it was really quite a momentous sort of situation. At any rate, instead of proceeding immediately to the answer for which he's so famous, he asked for time to think his answer over. Since he said this is such an important matter, I would like to have some time to think it over. And they gave it to him. They gave him 24 hours. He would get an opportunity to think about it, and so they whisked him away, and for the next 24 hours or so, he could reflect, he could pray, he could talk with his friends before finally giving his answer on the next day.
On the next day, Luther enters the hall again, and he apparently is asked the same question yet again.
That is exactly right. Same as before, he's asked, will you disavow these works or do you defend them? He had been told he shouldn't prepare an answer in writing, but in point of fact, he did prepare an answer in writing. So this time, he speaks in a what's described as a clear and a confident voice, very well prepared, and really remarkably bold. What he does in his answer is to talk about his books. And he indicates that they are of three different kinds. The first kind is about basic Christian faith and morals. Nobody, he said, had ever objected to works of that sort. Even his opponents had acknowledged that some of the things he'd said about prayer and so forth were correct and good. So he says, well, I certainly can't take those books back. I can't repudiate those. That would be, you know, denying Christ. Then he says, I have a second category of works which are against the Pope, against the papacy. And I've written against the papacy because papal rules, regulations, and teachings impose burdens upon consciences, torture consciences, and at the same time squander the resources of the people of Germany. Certainly, he says, I can't take those things back. That would be the same as, giving in to tyranny and approving of this continued exploitation of the church by the papal bureaucracy. Finally, he said, I have a third kind of books, and these are ones that I have directed against individuals who have written against me, who defended the abuses in the church and wanted to overturn what I have written about the true faith. He did kind of apologize for those. He said, I've been too harsh in the way I have written some of those. But he says, I'm not a saint, and the debate that we're having is not about personalities. It's not about who's the better Christian from a moral point of view. It's instead about the truth of the gospel, the truth of Jesus Christ. And so I can't take those books back either. And then he went on to say, but of course, what I have asked for from my opponents all along is that they show me on the basis of the scriptures where I have done something wrong. So he holds out kind of the possibility that if somebody, even at this late date, would use the scriptures, would use the gospel to show him his errors and mistakes, then he'd be perfectly willing to retract any errors that they can so demonstrate. But failing that, he wasn't going to retract anything. He concludes this little part of a quotation here that I think is pretty good. I say, he concludes this part by saying, to reject the word of God for the sake of peace and quiet would be a terrible beginning to this imperial reign. Scripture shows continually that God surprises the experts in their cleverness and overturns the mountains before they are aware of it. It is God who must be feared before all else. With these words, I commend myself to your majesty and your lordships, humbly beseeching you not to allow the anger of my opponents to discredit me unjustly. I have spoken. And then he does something very interesting. He says, now, do you want me to repeat my answer in Latin? Because, of course, he'd been speaking German all that time, and but not everybody who was there, especially representatives of the church from Italy and so forth, would have been able to follow it. So he was willing to do the whole speech again, this time in Latin, and of course he did. He presented his answer a second time, this time in Latin. But when he was finished, the emperor's representative wasn't completely satisfied because it sounded to him and to others that because Luther said at the end of this he was still willing to take back works if errors were shown to be in them, that he hadn't fully answered the question. And it was at this point that he was pressed to answer even more clearly and was said, give us a yes or no answer. Will you retract your books and all the errors that they contain? Yes or no. And it's at this point that Luther gives the very famous part of his answer, really not a part of his prepared remarks, but kind of from the heart or from the spirit. And it's at this point that he says, since your majesty and your lordships desire a simple reply, I will answer without horns and without teeth. Unless I am convinced by scripture and plain reason, I do not accept the authority of popes and councils, for they have contradicted each other. My conscience is captive to the word of God. I cannot and I will not recant, for to go against conscience is neither right nor safe. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen. And that, of course, and interestingly, that very last sentence, I cannot, Can't do otherwise. God help me. Amen. That he said in German. The rest of it had been Latin, but kind of at the very end, the emotion of the situation finally getting to him, he breaks into his mother tongue and simply refuses to recant.
Now, I do note in the quote, and there are various versions
right.
of this quote that float
right.
around in historical renditions of this event.
Right.
I noticed in the version that you read there were not the words, "Here I stand,"
right.
which have been carved into many a bronze
yeah.
of Martin Luther.
Yeah, and he could have said this. The quotation, "Here I stand," does not appear in the earliest accounts of Luther's speech. They occur in later accounts. And does it mean that the later accounts are more accurate than the earlier ones because they're more complete? That's a possibility. But I think, well, the one historian that I kind of rely on for stuff like this is Martin Brecht, who's written the definitive three-volume work, and he suggests that he doesn't think "Here I Stand" was part of the authentic.
And others have said that Luther at one time even autographed a picture, a depiction of him at the hearing at Worms,
mm-hmm.
with the words "Here I Stand." Martin Luther, love and kisses, or something like that.
I don't know that story.
The aftermath. This is obviously
yeah.
confrontational. We have a few minutes here left in our conversation.
Yeah, sure.
What is the aftermath of the hearing at Worms?
Well, one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that there were some negotiations between imperial counselors and statesmen, including imperial churchmen and Luther, to see if they couldn't yet negotiate some sort of compromise. Would he take back some things and not others? Would he agree to be silent in exchange for his opponents also kind of backing off? Those negotiations come to nothing. The emperor really was, when Luther was done, the emperor was convinced. On the very next day, he called in Frederick the Wise and others and told them that he wished that he had never permitted Luther to have this hearing, that having heard Luther, he was convinced that Luther indeed was a heretic, not because Charles was in any sense equipped to judge Luther's teachings, but he was a man of authority, and he had no interest in somebody who defied authority, and that's how he saw Luther behaving in this context. And then there's a sense in which that was right, of course. But for the sake of the gospel, Luther was willing to defy authority. So Charles indicated that he was ready to proceed with an official imperial condemnation of Luther. It took a while for that to be drafted and presented, and it wasn't until the very end of the Diet that the Edict of Worms was brought forward. The emperor did turn it over to the princes, particularly the leading princes of the empire, for their discussion. Frederick the Wise and another of the princes who was favorable to Luther left early, or weren't present, I should better say, for these negotiations and discussions. And so at the very end of the Diet, actually even after the Diet had adjourned, Charles did promulgate an official condemnation of Luther, his works, and his followers. This is a so-called Edict of Worms. And by this edict, Luther was an outlaw of the empire, not only excommunicated from the church, but also declared an outlaw, which literally meant he was outside the protection of the law. Luther's books were ordered to be burned. Anybody who protected him likewise fell under the condemnation of being an outlaw. So it was kind of the secular equivalent of what the church had done. Both together, church and state, had now condemned Luther.
So by the time all is said and done, Dr. McKenzie, we really have a man who, in a sense, against the world, standing there with the proclamation of the gospel
right.
and the condemnation of the church's errors. He has been condemned by the Pope and a bounty put on his head for his life. He's been condemned by the empire and declared to be someone that people could kill on sight if they mm-hmm. found him on the road.
Right.
And he has to depend the rest of his life on the protection of Frederick and his prince.
Yeah, right. I think that's important for your listeners to know that God did raise up men like Frederick who were likewise willing to risk a great deal themselves in order now to protect Luther and to side with him. And Frederick's a very skilled politician. One thing that, in preparation for our conversation here that I ran across I hadn't known before, was that Frederick, at some point early on here, got permission from the emperor not to publish the edict in Saxony. In other words, kind of a special exemption from the emperor from having to enforce what the emperor had just said should be enforced against Martin Luther. But Frederick was willing to take that risk, and so Luther and Lutheranism survived the Diet of Worms.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, thank you for joining us as our guest on Issues, Etc.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it, Todd. Thank you.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie is professor and chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We've come to the end of this conversation on the hearing at Worms, the Diet at Worms, and you're probably saying to yourself, but what happened next? There's one way you can find out, and that is to get a hold of our Issues, Etc. book of the month for October. It's called Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. It includes not only greater detail than we can go into here on 1 hour of radio, even with the ablest of guests like Dr. Cameron McKenzie, in the events of the Diet of Worms, but all those that came before and after as well. Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther, is our Issues, Etc. book of the month for October. You can call Concordia Publishing House in the next half hour, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The book is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Or go online tonight, issuesetc.org. At our website, you'll find the What's New section. Click on that. Under that, you will find information on this Issues, Etc. book of the month for October, Lift High This Cross. You can also visit one of the two locations that Concordia Publishing House has for bookstores, either here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton or at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. When we come back from this break, another hour-long conversation, turning our minds to the subject of Mormonism. How do we respond to Mormon truth claims? They are equipping themselves, the Mormons are, not only with vast numbers of missionaries, but also with apologists, scholars who are working on, as we speak, a defense of Mormon truth claims in very scholarly and academic ways. Dr. Frank Beckwith will join us in the next hour, Associate Professor of Church and State Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and co-editor of a book called The New Mormon Challenge to talk about responding to Mormon truth claims. When we're done with that conversation, we'll have a live report from London where the 38 primates of the Anglican Communion have concluded their meeting. We'll be right back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc. What motivated one man to stand against the most powerful institution of the 16th century? Why the relentless pursuit of Martin Luther to reform the church? Issues, Etc. and Concordia Publishing House invite you to delve into the life, writings, and teachings of Luther with our book of the month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy by going to our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. Find out how God worked through this reformer to shape church and society. Lift High This Cross costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. When you call or write, mention Issues, Etc. and our Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross.
This is Family News.
The Fall Color
Caravan
Travel Guide is now available from the Alton Regional Convention and Visitors Bureau. Take a fall color drive past apple picking orchards, roadside cider stands, and pumpkin patches. Drive the Great River Road. Every weekend, now through November, you can discover new and different festivals, fairs, and fun for the whole family. The best of the season in the Fall Color Caravan Guide from the Alton Regional Convention and Visitors Bureau. Visit their website at visitalton.com.
Issues Etc. and Concordia Publishing House are excited about our Book of the Month for October. Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. Find out how God worked through this reformer to shape church and society. Lift High This Cross, published by Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book at issuesetc.org and click the What's New section, issuesetc.org.
A new rule by the Bush administration recently went into effect, a rule that recognizes and assists unborn children.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The Children's Health Insurance Program, also called CHIPS, provides health care for children from low-income households, including unborn children. By providing this prenatal care, the government recognizes the unborn child and gives low-income women a better choice. Although radical abortion supporters fought against the measure, this is as pro-woman and pro-child as it gets, and the Bush administration is to be applauded.
The Susan B. Anthony List is dedicated to supporting pro-life legislation, training candidates and activists, and promoting pro-life leaders. To view all this month's commentaries, visit our website at sba-list.org. That's sba-list.org.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like, By the Way, Our Thought for the Day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, it's the Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment. Features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
I know that I have fallen into this temptation when it comes to dealing with the truth claims of non-Christian religions. Sometimes the claims seem so groundless, so baseless, that you're tempted to dismiss them out of hand, not even to consider the truth claims. Now, be careful here. I'm not saying that we ought to consider the truth claims as being true, but we need to know what they are and take them seriously in order to respond to them. Another danger is that we simply look at something like, say, for instance, Mormonism, and we say, well, it's so obviously wrong, it doesn't need a response from a Christian perspective. And if it does, all we need to say is, well, they believe this and that's wrong, and they believe this and that's wrong. To assert that they are wrong is one thing. To show that they are wrong is another. And meanwhile, you may not know this, Mormon apologists, scholars are busy at work trying to bolster the truth claims of Mormonism with scholarly work of varying degrees. How should we respond? We're going to talk about responding to Mormon truth claims during this hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. He joins us here in just a moment. Feel free to join us as well. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Frank Beckwith is a regular guest. He's Associate Professor of Church and State Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and co-editor of the new book, The New Mormon Challenge. Frank, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Well, thanks for having me.
We can't simply dismiss the truth claims of Mormonism out of hand, but are evangelical Christians losing the battle, in some sense, of truth claims, and yet they don't even know it?
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it. I think if you look at the world growth of Christianity globally, the number of people who have come to the Christian church in places like Africa, in South America and elsewhere, the Christian church, the classical Christian church, has grown much faster than Mormonism. So in terms of conversion, Mormonism, although growing very fast, is not outstripping classical Christianity. On the other hand, though, when it comes to the sophistication of Mormon arguments, evangelicals, I think, have been somewhat left behind. And there, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that most professional theologians and biblical scholars who deal with issues of biblical criticism and systematic theology and so forth don't take Mormonism seriously. On the other hand, most of the people in countercult ministries don't have the training to deal with many of the professors at Brigham Young University and elsewhere who are defending Mormonism at a much higher level than their predecessors.
What are the weaknesses of many Christian books on Mormonism?
I think, you know, I think the typical ones that you find out there have a lot of strengths, not only weaknesses. I think one mistake, and I think this may just be a mistake that that's maybe true of, I can even include myself in this group. I've written things that I wish that I had not written. I think there's a triumphalism sometimes in Christian books that will turn off a Mormon who would be open to reading a book critical of his or her faith. Sometimes the some of the Christian books out there are accurate in some aspects of Mormonism, but ignore, let's say, a group of Mormons who hold views that aren't mainstream. I'll give you one illustration of this. Typically, and I think this is generally accurate, Mormons believe in a finite God. That is, that God was once a human being and continues to be an embodied being that did not create the universe out of nothing but crafted it out of pre-existent matter. This is not the classical view of God. However, some Mormons are arguing that that the Mormon God, although bodily, is the creator of the universe in a much grander sense than, let's say, Joseph Smith had talked about prior to the end of his life. And the reason I think these Mormons are sort of flirting with traditional notions of God is that many of them have been educated at mainstream institutions of higher learning, where they come in contact with ideas that they otherwise would not have come in contact with. So I think that many of the books out there written by Christians are good. They just, I think, don't really inform people of the whole picture. I mean, it's the same feeling that I think we evangelicals get when we read a book about us. And even though there's some accuracy to it, we sometimes think that that makes us look one-dimensional, especially in the area of politics, where you read a book critical of, let's say, Christian conservatives, and the only thing the author picks on are, you know, Jerry Falwell or sort of popular TV ministers rather than our more sophisticated proponents. And so we get frustrated when we read that. Imagine how it is for, let's say, a Mormon who reads something that is technically accurate but really doesn't give a full-orbed presentation of his or her view.
What about those that would argue against Mormonism a la the mid-1800s, the Joseph Smith-era Mormonism, without taking into account what's been going on and actually what's going on right now in LDS theology?
Yeah, I think that would be it depends on the Mormon you talk to. there are Mormons that really run the gamut. Now, of course, the question that has to, that often gets raised to people like myself and my co-editors is, well, what's the official doctrine of the Mormon Church? And that's very difficult to figure out generally, just because of the amount of disagreement that the Mormon Church tolerates under its umbrella. Now, I do think that there are certain things about Mormon theology that seem to be essential and wide and almost universally held, one of which is that the universe was not created by God. That seems to be something that is a doctrine that Mormonism is going to have to abandon if it wants to join the ranks of Orthodox Christianity. But your question, it depends on where you find what Mormonism of the 18th century or the 19th century you're talking about, the early Joseph Smith writings tend to be very orthodox, although kind of idiosyncratic and odd, kind of eccentric. And then later on, Smith embraces a polytheistic, God is a temporal being with a body type theology. So even within the early days of Mormonism, there are about a half a dozen different views of God.
Is that part of the problem of engaging the truth claims of Mormonism, and that being it is a moving target, sometimes moving quickly, sometimes moving slowly, but moving nonetheless?
Yeah, in fact, Steve Robinson actually said that in the book How Wide the Divide that he co-authored with Craig Blomberg. He said, you know, I know it must be I know it's got to be tough for you evangelicals because we are, in a sense, a moving target, or it seems, or something along those lines. And I think that's right. I do think, though, that the fact that there is so much disagreement, even within the early days of Mormonism, even within the ideas of Joseph Smith, I think raises a question about Smith's own claims. Because Smith said that he was that God chose him to restore the gospel, but at no point as I said, there's so much disagreement that we're not clear which gospel has been restored.
So really, that's a good starting place with the Mormon.
Yeah, I mean,
I think simply, what gospel was supposed to be restored here?
I think it's an outstanding way, because in a way, what it does is you acknowledge the wide range of opinion within Mormonism. And say, you know, I know that, you know, you guys are, some people hold these views, and that some of your leaders have said this, but if that's the case, then how do you account for the claim that this is a restored gospel? I mean, that's a, you know, I want to know what it is. And I think what a couple of things that does, not only does it treat the person with respect, it also puts the Mormon in a position to present his or her views. And I think as Christians, we have to, it's not always good for us to be on the defensive. I think once in a while, it's nice for us to sort of ask the questions and to do so in a very Socratic or as I think from popular television, like Columbo would. You know, when he was investigating people as a detective on television. So I think that's right. Yeah, I think that, you know, it's important to raise questions like that.
All right. Before we talk about the new LDS scholarly apologetic, that is, it's not a lot, but it's actually there, and it needs to be taken into consideration. Does the apologetic impulse have a pedigree in the Mormon movement?
Yeah, you know, Mormonism, all the way back to its beginnings, had apologists. Parley Pratt and Orson Pratt are examples of two individuals. In fact, one of our contributors, Craig Hazen, wrote an outstanding article on early Mormonism and its apologetic impulse. One reason was that this was a time in the history of ideas in which the views of Hegel and Darwin were in ascendancy. And of course, Darwin seemed to teach a type of obviously evolution, but that there was a linear progress in nature that led to greater complexities. And Hegel taught that history was moving in one direction until you reach a time of perfection or a certain time in history when things will be well. And so Mormonism fits very nicely in this view of progress that was dominant in the 19th century. And so many Mormon thinkers, in defense of their faith, presented to the general public arguments that asserted that, look, this guy claims to be a prophet, and he's asserting ideas that are consistent with contemporary science and contemporary philosophy, and so we're on the right side of history. I mean, there is a sense in early Mormonism, an awareness that the Mormon materialism especially seemed to be consistent with the increased awareness of the importance of science and new discoveries and insights.
And then tell us about the new LDS scholarly apologetic.
Well, this is going to come as a surprise to a lot of Christians. Most Christians, when they think of counter movements, especially movements that came out of Christianity, whether it's Mormonism or Jehovah's Witnesses or Christian Science, I usually think that these are not sophisticated people, at least not sophisticated theologically. Well, the Mormon Church, I think, and its members, at least those that teach at places like BYU, I think are the way that they have educated themselves and presented themselves in the academic community is inconsistent with that idea. The Mormons that I know, some of whom teach at BYU, are individuals that have PhDs from Ivy League schools, first-tier universities, and have degrees in areas of study such as Near Eastern studies, philosophy, systematic theology, church history. And they've used their education and the resources resulting from that education in making a defense of the Mormon faith. Now, it's not something that we Christians would be familiar with, in the sense that there's not an explicit defense, let's say, of the Book of Mormon's infallibility. We're accustomed to seeing Christians defending, for example, the historicity of the New Testament. Much of Mormon apologetics is defensive. That is, let's say somebody says the Book of Mormon doesn't really read like a translation. It reads like somebody had just wrote this in the 19th century. Well, Mormons who are skilled in literary studies make the argument that it, in fact, exhibits the characteristics of a translation. Now, that doesn't go very far in showing that it's the Word of God or that's even historical, but it does respond to an objection. Now, one of our authors in the book does respond to the Mormon response, but the point is that there's a higher level of sophistication than in the past.
One of your authors says that a lot of the Mormon apologetic is an attempt to be a defeater of defeaters.
That's right.
That is, there's an argument that would defeat a premise of Mormonism, so the Mormon apologist sets out to defeat the defeater.
That's right. I mean, let me give you an example. Supposing, you know, as a Christian, I argue that God is a immaterial being that has always existed, and that he knows the future. Well, a Mormon skilled in biblical studies will say, well, wait a second. In the Old Testament, it seems that God has a body. Moses says that God passed by him. And that he saw his hands. Then there are passages in the Old Testament where God says that he forgets or repents. And isn't that consistent with God having a body and being an individual that was once mortal? Now, there are answers to that. But you see, for the ordinary Christian, who is, let's say, not skilled in hermeneutics or doesn't know the history of historical theology, where how people have responded to this, they can really be taken aback by this sort of argument. So, does that prove Mormonism? Absolutely not, because Mormonism could still be false, and that interpretation of the Bible still could be right, although I think it's mistaken. But what it does, it defeats a defeater. That is, here's an attempted response to the Mormon case that God has a body, and then the Mormon tries to defeat it with a rebuttal. But as I said, it doesn't establish Mormonism. It just simply wards off criticism.
We're talking with Dr. Frank Beckwith about how we respond to Mormon truth claims. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. Kurt is calling from his car. Kurt, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. I read the book by Richard Abanus, which I think he was interviewed on Issues Etc., and that's how I heard about the book. And it was it's a history of Mormonism, and it was fascinating and just a roller coaster ride of history. But I mean, Joseph Smith and the early Mormons, these guys were charlatans and crooks and nuts, and they had more than a dozen wives. And, I think that once you learn a little bit about the history of Mormonism, you just have to laugh it off. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And I can't take Mormonism seriously. Mm-hmm. And
Kurt, yeah. Thank you very much for the call. This is what we talked about a little bit before.
Yeah.
Now, I understand Kurt's impulse here, but how would you respond?
Well, I think you have to take any religion seriously that according to one sociologist, Rodney Stark, who happens to, by the way, be a visiting professor this year at Baylor, has estimated that if Mormonism continues at its current growth, I believe that he predicts they're going to have 80 million members. It will make it the next world religion. Now, Kurt may think that, and I am skeptical of Mormonism's truth, obviously, but as he is, but I think that we harm the cause of Christ if we don't take it seriously, and I think at our own peril if we ignore it. And imagine, though, you know, in the early days of the Christian church, people probably said, well, look, this is a crazy religion. You know, some guy claims to be God, and his followers say he rose from the dead. And, you know, they can dismiss it. But, you know, of course, the advantage is that Christianity is, in fact, true. I mean, but I do think that we have to take any religious faith that that seriously makes claims and has serious growth and is attracting a large portion of Christians. There's a joke among Mormons that they baptize one Baptist church every day in terms of the converts they're getting from Protestant denominations, whether it be Baptist, Lutheran, or Presbyterian or Methodist.
Yeah, one of the projections, which again you mentioned Rodney Stark, one of the things he says that in 1991 there were about 3.97 converts for every baptized child in Mormonism, that is, a convert from someplace else, and most of them from evangelical Christianity.
That's right.
But according to more recent data, that number is up to 4.23 converts for every baptized child.
It is remarkable. Now, you know, one theory that one of my co-editors has put forth, and we've had in private conversation, that he thinks that this Mormonism may change from the inside out largely because of these converts. That is, people that typically convert to Mormonism don't do so because they're persuaded that the theology that people like Kurt find to be odd, and I find to be odd, is true. They are attracted to Mormonism because of their family values, the warm communities that are that welcome people. And so one theory that one of my co-editors has is that at some point all these converts from evangelicalism and Catholicism are bringing to Mormonism their traditional theology. And that's one reason why I think there has actually been a slight shift in the past couple of years, because many Mormons, especially those that are recent converts, if you quiz them about Mormon theology, they really don't know much about it.
There are other avenues for the new LDS scholarly apologetic. Some of it has to do with pseudepigraphal writings, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and other things like that. Also, archaeology, linguistic studies, philosophy. Tell us about a few.
Okay, yeah, my background's in philosophy, so I can talk a little bit about that. Now, the other studies, I'll just briefly mention that Mormons have been in the forefront of the Dead Sea Scrolls research. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, BYU actually has is the place. They actually have a campus now in Jerusalem, specifically targeting archaeological sites for research, and they actually, if I'm not mistaken, they also are in charge of keeping the Dead Sea Scrolls, although I'm not 100% sure about that. In what they've done, especially in some of these ancient writings, what they attempt to do is to find in those ancient writings beliefs held by, let's say, Jews in the intertestamental period or early Christians that seem to be consistent with Mormonism. I'll give you one illustration of the sort of argument. Several years ago, I think almost a decade now, David Paulson, who's a philosophy professor at BYU, wrote an article for Harvard Theological Review pointing out that, or making the argument that there were early Christians that believed that God had a body. And he cited as evidence of this the fact that St. Augustine and Origen both mentioned these sorts of Christians in their writings. Now, there's nothing in Paulson's article talking about Mormonism or defending Mormonism. He just simply cites this as a bit of research that he thought was interesting. Now, if you know a little bit about Mormonism, however, you can see what he's doing. He is putting into print in an academic periodical an argument that may be used by, let's say, some Mormon missionaries or another scholar by citing Harvard Theological Review. That carries a lot of academic weight in some circles. So now, once again, none of this proves, of course, Mormonism, because one could easily argue, well, yeah, some early Christians did believe that God had a body. There were also early Christians that were Gnostics and Judaizers, too. I mean, how do you know which ones are the right ones? We have an entire tradition that has established which ones are the right ones. Now, of course, Mormons reject that tradition, but there's a sort of but this sort of argument is an attempt to defeat the argument that one often hears that Christians have always believed that God doesn't have a body.
You know, I've been guilty of assuming that if you took the average Mormon and sent him off to an Ivy League school, taught him how to do sound biblical exegesis, or taught him how to do the sound science and art of archaeology or linguistic studies of philosophy, that they would see through the truth claims of their faith and simply recant. It sounds like there are a lot of people of scholarly merit mm-hmm. who are devout Mormons
mm-hmm.
and who are using their scholarly skills, at least in an indirect way, to bolster the truth claims, or at least to attempt to bolster the truth claims of Mormonism.
But that's right. And in fact, you have, as many of them are very well educated. In fact, there's a fellow Harvard Law School graduate who has a website where he defends Mormon theology. There are others who actually have degrees in biblical studies and theology and Near Eastern studies from as I said, some real outstanding institutions. I do think, though, that one of the mistakes I think that I think we all make is that we assume that that education has the power to let's say, alter somebody's worldview, and in some cases it does, but if somebody is emotionally and firmly committed to a point of view, they will interpret their education as an opportunity to further the goals of their group. And that's something we all do. I mean, I'm not saying that's a bad thing necessarily, but I do think that if one grew up a Mormon and one, let's say, was firmly committed to this, it is difficult to give those things up, but although not impossible.
Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Church-State Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, co-editor of the book The New Mormon Challenge. Now, when we come back, we're going to talk about something called Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy. This is another thing that needs to be taken into account. Someone has once said that Mormon Neo-Orthodoxy may be closer to Protestant fundamentalism and neo-orthodoxy than to traditional Mormon thought. I guess it raises the question, is Mormonism in any sense, Christian? And if it isn't, is it headed that direction? We'll talk about that when we come back. 1-800-730-2727 is our call-in number. 1-800-730-2727. We also have a live in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're responding to Mormon truth claims with Dr. Frank Beckwith, Associate Professor of Church-State Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and co-editor of the book, The New Mormon Challenge. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.